Welcome to Season 4 of The Great Humbling. My name's Ed Gillespie, and I'm a futurist, a poet, and a recovering sustainability consultant. In the spring of 2020, during the first lockdown, I began recording a series of conversations with Dougal Hine, co-founder of a school called Home. We started with a question. What if it makes sense to think of ourselves as living in a time of humbling, being laid low, brought down to earth? Pulling on that thread has taken us further and become more central to our work than either of us expected. So we're back now with an open-ended series as part of the wider patchwork of homewardbound.org. Thank you for listening. Welcome back. This is episode 2 of this fourth series in our new, more or less monthly format. How's that feeling for you, Dougal?
Well, less of a rush, I guess. We've been used to doing like 8 episodes in 8 weeks in a series before, and that's got a particular intensity to it. I always felt like it took a week or two to get properly into the zone. And often there was a point midway through or towards the end of a series when it felt like we broke through to a new level of depth. And the Get On Your Knees episode about prayer in the last series was definitely one of those, one of the most vulnerable episodes we've done for my part, and certainly the one that I've heard back from people about the most. But if I'm honest, there's also often a point in mid-series where I felt like the pace of the recording schedule was sort of running away with me, and I wasn't able to give every episode the care and attention that I wanted to. I'm curious, Ed, how does it work with your other podcast, The Future Noughts? Do you guys have a relentless schedule when you do a series?
Well, yes. So our current third series has already suffered a disruption due to various nightmarish diary shenanigans, especially when you're trying to coordinate interviews, which gives our rather brilliant producer, Michael, time to edit our witterings. We actually went off air for a fortnight after only 3 episodes as a result of all of that chaos. But and that generated much Twitter grumbling from our audience. But I think it's worth remembering that the vast majority of podcasts are not done for the money, and certainly not this one. They are authentic labours of love in a gifting economy of content. So as you and I have discussed previously, when we've had our own scheduling glitches, we should perhaps go easy on ourselves and not make ourselves involuntary hostages to the recording. Because if we're not present, engaged and enjoying ourselves, then it's unlikely our listeners will be when they tune in, unless they're sadists. Or, of course, masochists.
I was thinking our audience could be grumbling on Twitter, and I wouldn't know because I haven't been on Twitter since about 2017 anyway. But I was talking to Ingrid Reeser the other day, who does a wonderful podcast called Forest of Thought. In fact, I had the honour of being invited back as, I think, her first return guest. And we did a live recording with an audience at the City Library in Uppsala a couple of weeks ago, starting with the question, does it still make sense to talk about climate change? And I've got a feeling we'll be coming back to that ourselves in a future episode. But Ingrid was saying the thing that takes most work with her podcast is finding guests and immersing herself in their work so she can really find the line that she wants to follow in the conversation with them. And she said, I kind of envy friends like Per Johansson and Erik Quilt who do the Swedish language podcast, Myter och Mysteria, which I highly recommend. Because they don't have to find guests. They just get together and talk to each other. And I was like, that's basically me and Ed, isn't it?
Exactly.
So what did you get up to in November, Ed? Did you go to COP?
Well, as my late father used to say, the answer's not just no, it's fuck no. No, it's not my bag. I have never been to a COP. And although I have many activist friends who love the connections, the solidarity and the joy of the movement amongst the inevitable tooth grinding frustrations, it's not my thing. So I've been hunkered down in South Norfolk as the winter nights draw in like a darkening veil. Although on your does it still make sense to talk about climate change point, I did do a talk at TEDx King's Cross the other week, which has gone live today, where the theme was, how are we going to solve climate change? And I basically stood up and said, look, thinking about this as fixing or solutions is completely misunderstanding the nature of the broken relationships, of which the climate and ecological crises are just symptoms. But as you say, we'll no doubt return to that theme in a forthcoming episode. So whilst I've been in amongst the Norfolk reeds, close to the damp and humbling earth here, have you been out and about?
I did have the weird experience of travelling to the UK by train around the first days of COP. But I was going with Alfie, who's six, to visit his grandparents for the first time since the start of COVID. And I think, you know, I came to the conclusion after my early experiences as an anti-globalisation protester that this thing of, you know, big summits and convergences of activists and global decision makers are not a place that I'm interested in being around. I mean, I went for a ride on a Birmingham bonnet at the 1998 G7 meeting there. And I remember spending the Glen Eagles G8 flitting between roles as a journalist and a protester, caught in this surreal spectacle of it all, the sense of maybe not fully conscious collaboration between police and black bloc anarchists and Make Poverty History and film crews to stage this performance of the good protesters and the bad protesters. While on the ground, it all felt much messier, a patchwork of perspectives and intentions, many of which never touched the media narrative of all that. Mm.
I was there too. I spent the Make Poverty History March in Edinburgh in a kilt with a George Bush codpiece underneath. those were the days.
I'm not going to offer any comment on that. One thing I will say, I did notice traveling across Europe by train, I heard more conversations about climate change between passengers than I've ever done before. Mm. So that did give me a sense that it is more present in people's minds than it was a few years ago, even after the way that COVID intervened and interrupted a lot of the climate activism we were seeing in 2018, 2019. Maybe I can shoehorn a segue out of that to what I wanted to talk about with you this month, which is this idea of the commonplace. We're calling the Homeward Bound site that is home, among other things, to this podcast, the commonplace book of a school called home. And this calls on the old idea in rhetoric of the commonplace, or topos, which my old friend from another life, Mary Harrington, explains as these puns, sayings, cause and effect cliches, and other mimetic structures that could be used by a skilled rhetorician to draw listeners in by offering a known resting place of shared ideas or ethical content, whose re-rehearsal would then strengthen the bond between speaker and listeners. This idea of finding these commonplaces, things that we can meet around that make conversations possible. So I guess we'll come back around to that particular sense of the commonplace in the course of this episode. But Ed, maybe you can do your thing and get us into the etymology of this language of commons.
So if we start with common, you know, it basically defined as belonging to all, that which is owned or used jointly, or of a public nature or character. And that comes from the old French commune, which means common, general, free, open or public, which in itself then comes from the Latin communis, that which is in common, public, or shared by all or many. So you need to go deeper than that, though, because then you get down to the sort of proto-Indo-European root, which is komoini, which is that which is held in common, which comes from ko, which means together, to moin, which is a suffixed form of the root mei, which actually means to change, to go, or to move. And so it's like how we change, go, or move together, which is where the kind of definition of shared by all comes from. And interestingly, mei is also the source of the Latin munia, which means duties, or public duties and functions. You then have the idea of being common, which has been used disparagingly since at least the 13th century. And ultimately, all of this thread sort of brings us to the idea of the common good, which comes from the Latin bonum publicum, or the common weal, as it was defined in the 14th century. And also, if you've watched Hot Fuzz, the idea of the common good is used to very dark effect.
Oh man, can we just have a moment of appreciation for Hot Fuzz? I think, maybe you had to grow up watching English detective dramas to love that film. It's also riffing off the buddy logic of American cop shows, but it's one of those movies that I just find a total pleasure to watch and rewatch.
This is a classic, great humbling segue from, you know, the etymological roots of the common the commons to Hot Fuzz. But yeah, that Cornetto trilogy of Shaun of the Dead, Hot Fuzz and World's End is a collective masterpiece of modern British cinema. But actually, the commons in some ways is like the partnership between Simon Pegg, Nick Frost and director Edgar Wright, you know, a sort of fellowship. But really what we're talking about here is the commons as a space belonging to all or of the people collectively, as in the House of Commons, although we could go down a very dark rabbit hole of political shenanigans if we start to talk about that being a place belonging to all.
Well, we've certainly opened up a whole pile of stuff now just through those definitions, but there is a particular thread of talk about commons that's been very important in the history of environmentalism. So maybe you could take us further into that.
I want to start with Garrett Hardin's Tragedy of the Commons, or perhaps Tragedy of the Unregulated Commons. And I first came across this theory when I was a fisheries biologist, but it was argued to apply to any open access, unregulated resource, whether that's fish in the sea or the atmosphere we are currently hotly debating in the context of climate change. And it actually goes back to an 1833 pamphlet by the economist William Foster Lloyd. And he postulated that village cattle herders grazing their animals on shared common land would individually be incentivized by their own self-interest to graze more cattle each, as they would personally reap the benefits, while the costs of that overgrazing would be shared by all. And Hardin argued that this would lead inevitably to the depletion, degradation, and destruction of the commons for everyone, and possibly everything. And so you can see why it rings a few climate alarm bells right now. Now, Hardin expanded this and popularized the concept in 1968 when he suggested that relying on conscience alone in the management of the commons favors the selfish free riders over more altruistic members of the community, and effectively confronted the idea of autonomous individual freedom in disconnection from the collective whole, arguing that management of the commons for everyone enabled the preservation and nurturing of more precious human freedoms. And once you sort of understand that Tragedy of the Commons conceptually, you see it everywhere. I mean, I studied the collapse of the Grand Banks cod fishery, but equally the demise of the Aral Sea through extractive irrigation, and even car exhaust pollution are also good examples of the failure to internalize or account for those external costs. And those external costs can be really problematic, as Professor Johan Rockström of the Stockholm Resilience Centre says, you know, the planet is starting to send back invoices to the economy. But the pandemic also shows how those who defy or reject public health recommendations can also despoil the public realm of common goods. You know, our collective well-being, the overloading of the healthcare system, the economy, or, you know, even actually literally the air we breathe. I mean, and other examples are, you know, like light pollution. People have been getting exercised by Elon Musk's mini satellite trains, altering the night skies as the common heritage of all mankind. Or, you know, in a more conventional sense, the old growth forest logging, which, as Tyson Juncker-Porter says, is irreplaceable on anything less than 1,000-year timescales. Or even, in fact, population growth, where you're starting to see people taking birth strikes, you know, in the teeth of the climate and ecological crisis. And it brings this idea around that freedom of the commons brings ruin to all. But yet, you know, there was then the famous work by Eleanor Ostrom, who revisited Hardin's theory and, you know, won the Nobel Prize for Economics in the process. And she cited myriad examples of common resources managed well by members through mutual shared interest. And she said, you know, this was down to factors such as, like, it's easier to manage bound or defined resources like land. You know, and particularly with my fisheries hat on, it's much simpler to do that, obviously, than when you're trying to manage highly migratory fish species like tuna that don't tend to respect any national or indeed international boundaries. also where the members of that community have a degree of resource dependence. So where there is real risk involved in depletion, as no substitutes exist, and obviously people aren't completely daft. Thirdly, is where you get these thickly socially networked local communities that promote the right social norms of good conservation practice. And perhaps fourthly, the stick, which is, you know, some firm rules, the appropriate incentives and punishments for transgressions. So it's a really old idea, which has been both denigrated and celebrated as potentially the salvation or ruin of us all. So it's ambiguous.
Well, this is really interesting because it's one of those places where the things that you and I have studied or worked with over the years cross paths from really quite different directions. Because I was drawn into this conversation about the commons in my late 20s through my friendship with Anthony McCann, who in those days was running a site called Beyond the Commons that grew out of his research on Irish traditional music and the extension of copyright to live sessions in bars in the 1990s and the role of that in killing off what he calls the heart of the commons. And there's a brilliant text of his, Enclosure Without and Within the Information Commons. And what Anthony says there is that there are two different ways of talking about this thing we talk about as a commons. On the one side, there are people who conceive of the commons as a particular character of uncommodifying social relations in a localized context of community. And on the other side, those who see the commons as a resource pool to be managed. And historically speaking, when people talk about the commons in the first way, they tend to seek to defend it against enclosure. While when they talk about it in the second way, they tend to be enthusiastic about enclosure. And literally, enclosure is the phrase that comes, or the word that comes from the history of common land in agriculture in England, the fencing off of pastures that had previously been used in a way that resembles the hypothetical situation that Hardin starts with at the beginning of The Tragedy of the Commons, except for one important detail, which is that they didn't end in the kind of collapse and exhaustion that Hardin assumes is the natural course of events without the privatization of the land. But the heart of this really is about whether or not the world is made of resources. There's a short text by Ivan Illich, a talk he gave about 40 years ago at a conference in Japan called Silence is a Commons, where he says, I want to distinguish the environment as commons from the environment as resource. Now, a lot of the time, especially in modern environmentalism, we talk as if it's obvious that the world is made up of natural resources. But a resource is a raw material for the production of a commodity. And what Illich is saying is, when we look at the commons as something that has actually existed historically, rather than in Hardin's historically illiterate thought experiment, the commons is a way of treating the world, or parts of the world, as not destined to be turned into commodities. So describing that historical phenomenon of the commons in rural England, Illich says, people called commons that part of the environment which lay beyond their own thresholds and outside of their own possessions, to which, however, they had recognised claims of usage, not to produce commodities, but to provide for the subsistence of their households. You can take for purposes of use, but not for purposes of exchange. And the thing is, there's actually nothing difficult about that distinction. I mean, Ed, you must have stayed in your share of Swedish hotels over the years.
Yes, I most certainly have frequented a Scandic hotel room or 50.
Right, so you've partaken of the smörgåsbord, the huge spread of a breakfast buffet.
Yes, I've grazed ones which have won Scandinavia-wide awards. They are the epitome of abundance, though in my experience it's best to demur from the brown Norwegian cheese.
Well, so we all know the code that governs that situation. You can take to meet your own needs. You can eat as much as you want. And there might be the odd grey area. I remember getting busted in a Norwegian youth hostel in the mid-90s for making myself sandwiches for lunch from the breakfast buffet. But what's clear enough is that I can't set up a stall on the street outside and keep taking food from the smorgasbord and going out and selling it to passers-by. So it's not hard to draw the line between rights of use and rights of exchange. It's not something that feels abstract or artificial. In fact, you could say it's common sense. And it's only capitalism that does its best to obscure our ability to make distinctions like this and encourages us to see it as natural to treat the world as essentially made up of resources for the production of commodities for exchange in the pursuit of profit. And people who take seriously this thing of the commons as a different way of seeing and living in and treating the world, in the way that Illich does, or Anthony McCann, or me, we tend to be ambivalent about Eleanor Ostrom's work. Because yes, she did an important job of rebutting Hardin's seemingly logical story about why commons are doomed to failure. And in fact, you know, even in the cases that look most convincing, you know, if you look at the fisheries, if you actually go and read Dean Bavington's book, Managed Annihilation, on what happened with the Grand Banks cod fishery, you find it's a very different story to the sort of Hardin tragedy of the commons version. But in order to make the case that Ostrom made for the viability of the commons, she had to look at historical commons in all sorts of different times and places and analyze them through the lens of resources, using concepts that project the assumptions of economics back across the whole of human history. And the danger there is that when you do that, you lose something important. You lose the sense of how differently people have seen and experienced and treated the world when the logic of the commons has played an important part in their ways of living.
I haven't read Managed Annihilation, but that basically sums up why I moved on from fisheries biology, realizing, you know, my entire career was going to be spent saying, if you don't stop catching all the fish, there won't be any fish. Yeah, adding to a kind of a rather unambiguous mountain of evidence to prove that point. I mean, it's really interesting that that backcasting of towards across history of the economic model is really pertinent. I'm currently merrily immersed in the late great David Graeber's book with David Rengrow, The New Dawn of Everything. And they make this point articulately and repeatedly. And what they do is they brilliantly challenge the reductive simplicity of that inevitable birth of civilization. You know, as humanity transitions from nomadic foragers and hunter-gatherers through the agricultural revolution, through to sedentary cities and dominant power structures and inequality in the nation state. And that this is all a nice, neat, linear narrative. And bollocks might be a succinct way of summing up their reaction to that rather one-dimensional narrative, though. And they use their typically meticulous research and compelling storytelling to do it. And the notion of the commons, perhaps in the sense that you're describing it rather than that Hardin and Ostrom sense, is implicit throughout. You know, across multiple locations on multiple continents over thousands of years, there are numerous examples of close-knit collaborative cultures living without obvious hierarchies in shared abundance and in the absence of centralized administration to manage those resources or indeed resort or revert to private ownership. And of course, you know, as it's Graeber, there's a subtext around the beauty of what appear to be fairly anarchic, self-organizing civilizations. But it also seems that there's a joyous collective element that alludes to your Illich point, like very, very different ways of seeing, experiencing and sharing the world that we're now told are primitive, unworkable or impossible. Or if they did exist, were just very rare historical aberrations on that simplistic arc. And they demonstrate the opposite in the book, in an absolute style, that showing human beings all over the world have for thousands of years created elaborate open cultures and experimental ways of being and working together, and that the world many of us live in now is no way an inevitable evolution conclusion or peak state of so-called progress.
So I guess it's also worth saying something about the rise of the language of the commons in the last half century or so, which arguably does start with Hardin. Because if you roll back to the early 1960s, the only people talking about the commons then were historians of English agriculture. And over the next 50 years or so, it spills out into being something that's talked about by ecologists and campaigners for internet freedom and social movements organizing to contest the privatization of urban space. And particularly in the last 20 years or so, there's been the emergence of a commons movement. And to talk about this just now, I want to name the huge shock and sadness that any of us who've been connected to these commons conversations feel at the unexpected death of Silke Helfrich, the co-founder of the Commons Institute. Because no one's done more or given more or had more to give to the convergence of thinkers and activists around the commons.
No, I didn't know that. And I didn't know her personally, but that's, well, like David Graeber, that's tragic.
It's this sense of losing someone who has given so much and who had so much left to give. So having said all this about how much the language of the commons has mattered to me, I've also been challenged this year by Chris Smage, the author of A Small Farm Future, who writes very persuasively on his blog about the danger of a misty-eyed tendency in contemporary thinking about land and community and food production. And what he's pointing out is that there's a fondness for holding up the commons in antagonism to the family farm, the small-scale domestic holding of land, where the latter is presented as something bourgeois, something reactionary, and we should put our hopes instead in collective forms of ownership and commoning. What Chris says is the historical commons were part of a way of life that has also generally involved private ownership. And it's there in that definition from Illich. If the commons is that part of the environment that lies beyond your threshold and outside of your own possessions, that presupposes that there's also a domain of production that lies within your threshold and inside your possessions. And that's because commoning isn't a beautiful transcendent experience of togetherness. It's hard work. Community is hard work. And romanticizing it isn't helpful, any more than it's helpful to romanticize what it's like to make a relationship and make a life together with a partner. To say something is hard work isn't to say it's a mistake, or to say it's not a source of meaning, but it can give us some realism. There are things that it makes sense to organize at the level of the commons and the community, and there are things that it makes sense to organize at the level of the household. And so against a utopian commonsism that is suspicious of private property, what I see in Chris and others who he's in conversation with is that they're digging into this legacy of distributism, a particular approach to private ownership of property and land, which, again, might be something we could come back to in a future episode.
As always, it seems to be about balance, isn't it? Not glorifying either the privatization nor the commons entirely over the other in some false binary way. And again, that's something Graeber refers to with this idea that people historically moved in and out of agriculture through what he calls play farming and innovated lots of new ways of living and relating that weren't static or one way, but were able to change. And it therefore makes sense to sort of combine the intimately private and the publicly shared in some way.
To bring this back around then to the idea of the commonplace and also to Homeward Bound as the commonplace book of A School Called Home, I guess there are a couple of reasons why that felt right as a way of naming what we're doing. First, it feels like a suitably humble claim. Mm. The history of the commonplace book, quoting Mary Harrington again, is as a journal in which the commonplace collector would write down quotes, ideas, images, sayings. So for me, by invoking that, we're saying this is first and foremost a place to gather together the varied material that we're finding helpful in the community around our school, which I know overlaps with the community of people listening to this podcast. And that's a different claim to if you say this is about seeking platform, trying to reach as many people as possible, rigging up a loudspeaker to compete in the noise, to gain a million followers. I'm just deeply not interested in that game. And I genuinely believe there are other things worth doing that involve creating quieter pockets of conversation assembling the stuff that is helping you make sense of things and putting it there in a way that may be helpful for others. It's a bit like Peter Lindbergh at the Stoa said a while back, stop looking at the readership metrics, write what you truly need to write. When Alfie and I were passing through London, we stayed with one of the new friends I've made in the time of COVID, Elizabeth Oldfield, who was the director of the Christian think tank Theos for the past decade, and who's still the presenter of their podcast, The Sacred, where she has conversations with people of all kinds of backgrounds and beliefs about our deepest values and the stories that shape us. And it was, I have to say, visiting Liz was one of those strange experiences where you've spent so much time talking to someone over screens, you can't quite believe that you've never really met them in person. A bit like you and me, Ed.
Well, yeah, I do sometimes wonder whether you're just a figment of my imagination or some sort of hairy, bookish avatar sent to infiltrate my online reverie.
Would I tell you if I was?
Yeah, welcome to the Matrix.
So after I got back from that trip, I was listening to a few episodes of The Sacred. I was particularly struck by the one they did to mark the second birthday of that podcast, where they turn the tables and bring in the political journalist Ian Dunt to interview Liz and put the same questions to her that she usually puts to her guest. And she was talking in that about having been a producer at the BBC and working on The Moral Maze, and how she struggled with a format that required people to be so sure about what they think, and how the kinds of nuance or willingness to be uncertain that she values most in people's thinking are the opposite of what you have to look for when you're working for that kind of broadcast platform. So again, this idea of not aiming for a platform, not focusing on the size of your audience, but making room for nuance and uncertainty. But there's a paradox here, which is the kind of certainty and noise and polemic that Liz is calling into question there is also hugely implicated in the polarized nature of what we sometimes still call with a straight face the public conversation, whether it's on the Moral Maze or on Twitter. And so in the search for quieter ways of hosting sort of public conversations, I guess part of my hope is to find common places in one of the senses of that older rhetorical tradition, ways of talking that give us ground on which to meet, things we can recognise and speak together around, even when we don't come from the same place or share the same identities. And again, this feels like something to head further into in a future episode, because there is a wishy-washy, trying-to-please-everyone version of finding common ground, which is not what I want to speak for. But there's something else that I believe is quite radical just now, which is looking for these boundary objects, these observations that ring true across the dividing lines or culture wars that the algorithm wants us to be fighting, and that as they ring true can also offer us a different way to see things. The practice of looking for the commonplace rather than the divisive take it or leave it statement feels like one of the things I want to speak for. And I think now of someone else who I quote here from time to time, who I don't always agree with or totally trust, Gordon White of Rune Soup, because he also has this move of looking for the commonplace, the thing you can bring out in conversation that people who don't agree with each other can nonetheless agree on. Things can't go on like this is one example that I've heard him use. I'm not saying looking for the commonplace is the only move or the right move in every situation. Sometimes we need to draw the line, although it's better if we draw it for ourselves than to fall in behind a line that someone else has drawn for us. But I think it's a neglected move, an underappreciated one, and one that feels timely just now.
Thank you for listening to The Great Humbling. If you'd like to follow the threads in our conversations further, head over to homewardbound.org. We'll also find my Substack, Writing Home. You'll find us on Facebook as The Great Humbling, and Ed is at FruCool on Twitter. We're always glad to hear from those of you who are listening, and we're deeply grateful for all that our listeners do to spread the word and bring these conversations to new ears by sharing the podcast along your networks and giving it ratings or reviews on the platforms where you listen. These are strange and humbling times, and we need quiet corners, breathing spaces, air pockets and pockets of resistance, places in which to puzzle through how we got here and where we might be going. Thank you for helping us create one of those pockets.